Radio.
Same-sex attraction. A presentation by Father Thomas Lawyer during the Theology of the Body retreat held at the Mount Schoenstatt Retreat Center in Malgoa.
Hopefully it might be apparent to you, but the sequence of the talks was purposeful. So that we start out with basic fundamental. Remember the first night, just how to see Catholic, what that really meant. And all the way to now, we are taking that vision to these specific issues. Okay, and I believe that's how you have to do it. That the foundation and the vision, and then we take it to every issue. And that's what I do a lot of in my work in theology. But I do a lot of work in radio and stuff like that in taking it to the lived experience, because that's what it's for. It's not just a study. It's to transform our lives. Especially, in fact, my Table Life Institute, we say it's transforming lives through the theology of the body. So it's that ethos by which we look at everything. So now, this topic is, and we'll be a little bit shorter today because we have to go to Mass. I'm going to recommend something to you that just came out. I think you'll welcome this. It'll give you some real good ammunition. It's a magazine, a journal. It's called The New Atlantis, the fall edition. So it's brand new. I just got it. I ordered it right online for $10 American. And it's called The New Atlantis, A Journal of Technology and Society. It's a special report. Sexuality and Gender. Findings from the Biological, Psychological, and Social Sciences. And I'm going to read to you from the conclusion, because it has some very salient points that I would want to make on this issue. First of all, the operant word in all this is compassion. Now, compassion is the word the church would use. It's also the word that the secular world demands that we use. And they demand compassion. They consider to be these issues of sexual identity to be very sensitive issues, very sensitive issues. And of course, they think the church is insensitive, or anyone who doesn't speak a certain way about it is insensitive or prejudicial and homophobic, etc. Well, we use the word compassion as well. And so my point here is going to be, as always, what is true compassion? Just like a true purity of heart, we talked about last time, a true compassion. And true compassion is a function of truth. Absolute truth. Honesty. You know, I'm going to step in the age zone again, like I talked about last night. We have to be honest about things. What something actually is. That's the only way you can actually be compassionate. We are never compassionate by pretending things. We are never compassionate by ascribing to ideology, but rather to reality. The reality of the whole created order. The reality of things that are disordered. Reality, truth. That's the foundation for real compassion. And real compassion is what helps us to heal. Okay, from this journal, and again, it's the New Atlantis, number 50, fall 2016. Accurate, replicable scientific research results can and do influence our personal decisions and self-understanding, and can contribute to the public discourse, including cultural and political debates. Again, I'm reading from the conclusion. I don't mean to just read to you, but this is so, to me, so good. It's such a good summary and a sort of a springboard for me. When the research touches on controversial themes, it is particularly important to be clear about precisely what science has and has not shown. For complex, complicated questions concerning the nature of human sexuality, there exists, at best, provisional scientific consensus. Much remains unknown, as sexuality is an immensely complex part of human life that defies our attempts at defining all its aspects and studying them with precision. course, that would be my word, mystery, right? We know something, but it's still beyond us. And our sexuality is certainly a mystical, mysterious part of us. For all questions that are easier to study empirically, however, such as those concerning the rates of mental health outcomes for identifiable subpopulations of sexual minorities, the research does offer some clear answers. These subpopulations, we're talking about transgender, same-sex, these subpopulations show higher rates of depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and suicide compared to the general population. One hypothesis, the social stress model, and you hear this a lot, which posits that stigma, prejudice, and discrimination are the primary causes of higher rates for poor mental health outcomes for these subpopulations, is frequently cited as a way to explain this disparity. While non-heterosexual and transgender individuals are often subject to social stressors and discrimination, science has not shown that these factors have alone account for the entirety or even a majority of the health disparity between non-heterosexual and transgender subpopulations and the general population. So you got that? Got the point there? Okay. There is need for extensive research in this area to test the social stress hypothesis and other potential explanations for the health disparities, and to help identify ways of addressing the health concerns present in these subpopulations. Now, this is one of my most important points that I try to make on this issue. Some of the most widely held views about sexual orientation, such as the born that way hypothesis, simply are not supported by science. People are not born this way. You're not born with attraction to the same gender. You're not born with the idea that you have a male body, but you should have been a girl. And that's what this ideology is hanging its hat on. The literature in this area does describe a small ensemble of biological differences between non-heterosexuals and heterosexuals, but those biological differences are not sufficient to predict sexual orientation, the ultimate test of any scientific finding. The strongest statement, and this is a very important point coming up, the strongest statement that the science offers to explain sexual orientation is that some biological factors appear to an unknown extent to predispose some individuals to a non-heterosexual orientation. I want to pause right there and give you a very important distinction. They use the term disposed or predisposition. This is a very, very important point. Is not equal to predetermination. The reason why this is important, because this goes at the very crux of what the secular world and the transgender ideology like that are hanging their hats on. That people are born this way, and we just have to understand and let them live a way that they'll be happy. Okay, no science supports that. What there is certain predispositions, but that does not mean you are predetermined. Now, what are those predispositions? The predispositions are not predispositions to same-sex attraction or to transgender. These predispositions are what we would call, in the theology of the body, and in compassionate Catholicism, gifts. What do I mean by that? Let's go back to the artists. Where do we find a very high concentration, high percentage of people with same-sex attraction?
The arts.
The arts, exactly. Why would they be in the arts? Okay, very good. Gifts, which I will use another term, sensitivities. We talked about art before. It was a good lead into this. If you notice, what I was doing and what I was pointing out about other artists like Michelangelo or the artist that could capture a woman putting on a sock and make a masterpiece out of that. To do that requires a certain innate sensitivity. Okay, that's what makes the artist the artist. We have a sensitivity that other people don't. In other words, something strikes you, it affects you, and makes you respond that other persons, they wouldn't even notice, it wouldn't affect them. Okay? That's what's called sensitivity. Now, your sensitivity then becomes a predisposition, not per se for sexual same-sex attraction, but for a vulnerability for psycho-spiritual injury. Example. Let's see. I need three men and a woman. Stand up here, okay? If I can, just three guys and a woman. Just want to demonstrate something. Okay. Let's say you two are mom and dad. You're married, right? These are your two sons. Okay? Okay. You are, I'll call a normal dad, okay? You like sports, you like doing things, you know, working on your car or whatever, you know, you go to work, whatever. Okay, you're so-called, within the spectrum, what we call normal, okay? You have two sons here. This son is a lot like you. He is very good at what many boys can identify. You identify boys, what we call hand-eye coordination. You know what I mean by that? In other words, they're kind of rough and tumble. And remember I was telling you about the boy in the plane coming over here, a little toddler, and he's banging things on. Okay, boys start to identify, because by nature, they act on the environment, so they identify their masculinity. They develop their masculinity by what's called hand-eye coordination. Okay? They're rough and tumble. They do this, they bang, that. Eventually they do sports and stuff like that. Okay, your name is?
Jacob.
Jacob. And you?
Damien.
Huh?
Damien.
Damien, okay. Okay, Jacob has high hand-eye coordination, okay? So dad plays with him, right? Throws him the ball, they go out, hey, son, let's go out and play catch, okay? Wrestle around, throws him around like he did the baby last night, remember? Okay, Damien is also his son. Damien doesn't quite have the same hand-eye coordination. So what happens is, Damien, you stand next to your brother, okay, and your dad, okay, starts out this way. Damien starts to notice, as does his dad, that he's a little bit different than Jacob, okay, in this regard. But Damien has these other gifts. Damien's very good at art or music. So dad tries to relate with Damien. He knows that he can't play catch, or it's not as much fun. He doesn't like it as much. He's not as good. He seems like quieter. Seems like he would rather play the piano. Jacob would rather play catch or work with dad on the car or something. So Damien starts to notice he's different. And he starts to feel a little bit distant. Now, dad doesn't quite know what to do. He knows what to do with Jacob. He doesn't quite know what to do with Damien. So Damien starts to now feel a little distance from dad. Now, this starts to then develop into a bit of a hurt, little wound. Okay? So he starts to seek or identify with that which is more comforting, less hurtful, which would be mom or the feminine, the girls. A few years passed, and Damien is now a teenager. And he is noticed to be, by their guys, a little bit different. He's sensitive. He's not playing ball like Jacob is. He's not on the team at school. He's playing his piano. And so the boys might make fun of him, call him a sissy or something. Along comes another boy or man who looks at him, and he makes an approach to him that is sexual. And he has his first experience of sexuality in this way. What starts to happen then, it starts to send him now further and further on the road to disidentifying with Jacob, his dad, and the world of men. However, little Theodjabadi here. Remember going back to what I said about the male parts are how? External. I told the ladies yesterday, understand manhood by externality. We need things from the outside. Remember that? Remember the message? Okay. He's not getting that message that he measures up, that he's one of the boys. So he's feeling distant, more and more distant from this world. But he's still a man. And a man needs energy from other men. Remember, males don't become men naturally. They need something from the outside. They need something from other men. So they desire it. They need it. He is absent that. And so the yearning grows in him. What happens when we have a deep yearning or a hunger? You seek to satisfy that hunger, right? And if that hunger is very strong and very painful, what do? You will look at something like food and it will become very attractive to you, right? You will reach for it with a certain urgency, a rapaciousness. And so, Damien reaches for a man. And he begins to convince himself that he is so-called gay. Okay, let's rewind the tape now. He goes on from now to identify as a homosexual and to live that style. And the world is all too happy and ready to affirm him in that. Now let's rewind the tape and go back to the starting out. Do you notice what I did in this process? Was that through a process of woundedness to his identity as a person, through that process, he eventually translates his woundedness as a person, he translates it sexually, or quasi-sexually. You understand what I mean? It can't be sexual because sex requires complementary sexes. So it's quasi-sex. It's a translation. It's a translating out. It's sort of a seeking a place for the wound. Okay, you can sit down. Thank you. And this is why Damien was not predetermined, right? He had a predisposition, right? What was that predisposition? To becoming so-called gay? No. He had a predisposition, meaning he had gifts that were different than a lot of the other boys. Those gifts have nothing to do with same-sex attraction. However, on top of those gifts, depending on what happens to the boy developing or what doesn't happen, there is the vulnerability then to translate out that woundedness what happened or didn't happen in a quasi-sexual way. And this is why, as I said in the title of this talk, there is no such thing as a homosexual. The word itself is self-debunking. What does homo mean? What is one definition of the word homo? It's a Latin word. Like homogenous? Huh? One or same, right? Same. What is sexual? Sexual, by its very definition, means two different things, right? Complementary, male, female. It cancels each other out. How could you have same, different? Same, different. You get it? The very title itself is bogus. There are no homosexuals. There are only persons. Persons. Damien was a person. He wasn't born a homosexual. He was a person who, through no fault of his own, by what happened to him developmentally, especially at certain developmental critical stages in his life, put him on the course or made him vulnerable to translate out his developmental wounds in a quasi-sexual way. This is why, when it comes to sexual identity, there's like a continuum. You can be anywhere on this as we develop. The same-sex attraction is not some kind of crystallized state. It has a lot of flux to it. Someone who claims to be gay, I was just talking with a counseling a man with same-sex attraction. I am a chaplain for a local chapter of Courage. You know what Courage is? Courage is the ministry of the church to people with same-sex attraction who want to be faithful, but who struggle with that. I've also spoken at a national Courage conference. So I work with them. I'm all about compassion. That's why I was asked. I was asked to speak at the National Courage Conference because they looked up an article, an essay I have on my website, which you can see, taberlife.org, and they saw the fundamental, compassionate message of that article. And that's why they asked me to speak. But my brand of compassion is about truth. Not just, oh, this is what you feel, so I'll agree with you and make you happy. That's not compassion. That's selfishness. So the sexual identity, especially in men, can be on a kind of continuum. It's not like, okay, I'm here, this whole, I'm gay. No, you feel these things. You struggle with these things. But you can be here, 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 here. The young man I was talking to recently, to give an example, presents himself as homosexual, same-sex attraction, trying to be faithful to the church. But as he's talking to me, he's talking about how someday maybe he hopes to be married, have a family. Now, how could that be? What does that tell you? It tells you that the same-sex thing is not some kind of crystallized sexual orientation that happened at birth. It tells you that it is a translating out of other wounds that he has. I also want to refer you to a video. It's about 30 minutes long. You can get it if you haven't seen it already. I think get it on the internet. It's called The Third Way. The Third Way. The Third Way is a film with people with same-sex attraction giving their testimonies. And you will hear in their testimonies that the root, you hear all their testimony, the root of how they ended up in the whole same-sex world had to do with wounds that are much more fundamental to them as a person. As a person. It has to do with their identity, their self-image as a person. Damien, as he feels this rejection, he feels this distancing, he's feeling it. What he's feeling are things that have to do with our identity as a person, as a human being. You understand? Now, that's happening on the soil, the fact that he's a male, so it's going to strike him in a certain way. But the fundamental woundedness is on the level of him as a person. What did he experience? What was he experiencing?
Rejection.
Yeah, rejection. But that's neither male nor female. Okay? He was feeling rejection. He was feeling the lack of an affirmation needed as a man. It's not because he was gay. He was a person with these sensitivities, which are different than Jacob's. Therefore, he needed this and didn't need that. Jacob needed this, but didn't need that. It just so happened that Damien's needs were not met. Certain needs weren't met because of his gifts. Yes.
How would you suggest a father does deal with that situation? He's more the quote, and then his son more sensitive.
Yes.
How should he?
Very good, and I can talk from personal experience because, as you know, as you know now, art was my field. Okay, so and since I was a little boy, I was good at it, loved it. My father was like you, we pretend you are, you know. He worked on cars. He was very much a guy, you know. And I was his first son, but I was a little different than him because I was, you know, I mean, I was a normal guy and a boy too, but you know, I was good with sports, all that, but my sensitivities were inclined towards art and those kinds of things. So what my dad did, I think was crucial to my development, was that he affirmed me in that, and he kind of called me to a sort of a masculine approach to that, you know, to art. Like, he gave me the message that I yearned for as a boy, you know, from my father. Hey, that's pretty good. You draw pretty good. Yeah, you develop that. Then he'd go work on the car, you know. I was like, yeah. Oh, thanks, Dad. That's what I'm here. Then, later on, he'd buy me some paints. You know? Now, he was different than me. You know, I was different than him. We had different gifts, you know. My other brothers came along. My other brother was more like my dad, you know. They'd work on the cars together. I'd work on the car with him, but I'd hold the flashlight. You know how hard that is? No, he's yelling at me, over here! Okay. You know, you get fatigued. You know, stand over here! Will you hold that light? Okay. He had the easy part, working on the car. You try holding that flashlight right where he wanted. We'll put it over here! Okay. Now, my other brothers would come there, and they'd get on their wrenches, and they were good at it. I mean, I could do some of it, but they had, that gift. They're like my dad. They would chip off the block, you know. I had the sensitivity for art, okay? But I still played sports and all that stuff, too, you know. But I approached art, thanks to my dad's affirmation, in a, I guess you'd say, a masculine way. I was very competitive with it. It was like sports to me, man. I was like, you know, I'd go into contests and art contests. I would want to win and kick butt and beat that art, you know, and get the prize, you know. And I had a buddy, too. He was an artist, but he was a good athlete, too. And he and I were like, we were like the macho artist, man, of the school, you know. We would win all the contests, and we'd go on. We'd paint stuff people would never dream of attempting to paint, you know. So I took this masculine approach to it. But it's because, to answer your question, the father has to see the boy as he is and affirm him in that and encourage him to live it out in a sense of masculine way. In other words, to be more external with it, develop it, you know. Take it seriously, you know, go for it, you know, become good at it, you know. Yes?
And so what should the mother's approach be so as not to just encourage insistence at all?
Yes, the mother's approach That's very important. Her approach has to be affirming, not coddling, and not domineering, not trying to make up for, you know, maybe what dad couldn't give him. And it's very critical at the time when they enter adolescence. What I'm finding in my priesthood and my work here with people is having a lot of mothers that I have to kind of tell them, because they'll call me about problems with their sons when they're teenagers. And I have to gently explain to the mothers, this is not a place for you. Your son now is at the age where this is a place for your husband. He has to take care of this with your son. You can't do it. Because they're trying to make up for what dad maybe isn't doing, you know, and they can't do it. It'll mess up the kid, actually. Because the mother has a role in this, too. You know, a domineering mother can actually contribute towards this, can add to that predisposition. That's usually the combination. The classic combination is distant father, kind of a dominating mother, overcompensating mother. That's sort of the ingredient on top of the disposition, okay? It's not the disposition itself, it's what happens to the disposition, all right, that sets them on this course. Yes. Same-sex attraction women is a little bit different. It's similar in terms of what happens in parenting. But the other element is, again, go to theology of the body. Go to the woman's body. What did I say she was made for? What's that? What was her fulfillment? Relational what? Relational intimacy. Okay, relational intimacy is what she's primarily hardwired for. What happens with women is, for the men, the wound is an identity, you know, from the external. You know, he wants to hear from the men, especially his father, you're a man, you're one of us. Okay? The girl wants intimacy. When the girl is wounded in the area of intimacy, that's when she will gravitate or can gravitate towards the same sex. But it's a little different thing. Women who claim to be lesbians or whatever will have had, are having, or will have relations with men. Generally. For the boys, especially those that really identify with same sex, they generally aren't going to have a relationship with a girl. At least during that time. For the girls, they will have with a man. Either during the time that they're with another woman, before that time, or after that time. Usually it's before that time. Because one of the things that sets women onto the path of so-called lesbianism is deep intimacy wounds from a man and from a mother. And also the father, too. So the boys and the girls, maleness, femaleness, their meeting point, they meet at the point of common fundamental woundedness that has to do with the level of the person. Then as their wounds will manifest according to their maleness and femaleness, you know, how the path they go down. You understand? For the girl, it's going to be an intimacy thing, a relational thing. She's hurt, frustrated by intimacy. And intimacy is what she wants so badly, she'll get it however she can get it. Even if it means another woman. For the male, it's an identity thing. It's an acceptance thing. It's that message thing. You're a man. Rejected by the male world, he retreats towards the feminine. But he still desires the male. So, if you're starved from it, what do you do when you see it? You go into it. And that is being translated as, I love him, I want to be married to him. It's not love. It's need. It's need for woundedness. It's codependency. Now, can two men love each other? Yeah, they can. And as men draw from each other masculinity, I could go so far in working with them to say, okay, you two men live together. It seems like you're drawing something from each other in terms of masculinity that is seems to be life-giving, it's okay. Don't call it gay, don't call it marriage. It's okay for two men, they have that need to draw masculinity from each other, and they're going to be whatever close friends or live together, that's all right. But if you spill it over into so-called marriage and doing the lifestyle, you know, the quasi-sexual things, call it quasi because it's not really sexual. Sexual means you got to have two genders. Okay? So two men can't have sex. They have an imitation, they have a quasi, but they don't have sex. They can't. Sex means, see this important word, importance of words, sex means male-female. If it's not male-female, it's not sex. You get it? Okay. So two men can love each other, be together. If it seems like they're drawing something healthy from each other, that's all right. Because they need it. If they're getting it from each other in that regard, that's okay. But you cannot cross the line and say we're married or that we are gay. We're together because we're gay. You're not together because you're gay. And I tell gay men this. You're not together because you're gay. You're together because you're two men. And you need masculinity from each other. You didn't get it at certain times in your life. Now you're sensing it from each other. And if you're getting it from each other, okay, that's all right. But no quasi-sex, no marriage. That's a different thing.
That was Father Thomas Lawyer with Same-Sex Attraction. This presentation was part of the Theology of the Body retreat held at the Manschuenstadt Retreat Center in Malgowa, and which was organized by the Family and Life Office from the Diocese of Parramatta. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.